Hello and welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I am one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
And we are back for what is, I'm going to call week 25, John.
That would be what this week is.
Week 25 of us going through Dune Part 2. How in the world are you doing?
I am so tired.
You know, buddy, same. I think we both came into this recording a little worse for wear.
It's been a very busy week outside of the Dune Minute podcast. Mm-hmm. It's been a very busy couple weeks, honestly.
Yeah.
And it's also a holiday weekend right now.
It's true.
Not to set this in stone forever, but fuck it. We're going to do that. So I'm on a fucked up, weird ass sleep schedule, living my best life.
You're in the middle of a 4-day weekend.
I am. Oh, yeah.
I'm so jealous. I'm in the middle of a 3, so I can't be that jealous.
Well,
but how nice it would have been to have 4.
It's been pretty good. I can't complain.
Pretty good.
All right. Anyways.
Well, man, before we dive into Dune, I have a story to tell you.
A flight story?
A flight story.
Okay.
So I had
as people may or may not be aware, you are learning how to, you know, get your pilot's license and learning how to fly a plane.
That is very true.
Yeah.
And yesterday I had my first in-air incident.
Okay.
Now, not incident in the legal definition, but something happened.
You shit your pants.
No. Well, no. I think I would have been in my right to do so had I shat my pants.
Bird strike.
That's what I thought it was at first. Okay, so let me set the scene. So we have an afternoon flight yesterday, leaving about 12:30 p.m. Eastern time.
And for the record, yesterday's weather was fucking gorgeous.
It was beautiful. I have not been able to fly in about a month because it's just been raining every single weekend, it feels like. So this was the first time I've gotten up in a month. It was wonderful.
We're firmly in false fall where it's like... Mm-hmm. Still questionably going to get hot later on, but
it will. Yeah. But
it's been, you know, nice in the, you know, low 80s.
Yeah.
At the high.
Been real nice. So we take off about 12:30 p.m. 13:30 for those folks who are on military time, or 24 hour time, I should say. And we head up to a neighboring, city about, 30 minute flight time away. We circle their airport. It's an uncontrolled airport, so there's no tower we have to deal with. Since it is a holiday weekend, it was very, very not busy in the air. So we had pretty much free reign to do whatever we needed to do at this airport. It's great. So we do about 5 or 6 touch and go. So land and immediately full power, go up and just circle the airport and doing those.
Sure.
On the last one, we take off and we are heading towards home, which is in a southerly direction. And the way that these planes are built, I'm flying a Piper Warrior 2. So the way that these planes are built is that they have two flaps that cover the engine on either side of the fuselage.
So for people that may not be familiar with the Piper Warrior 2, is this a single prop in the middle?
Okay. Single prop in the front, yep, and low wing design. So whereas the other common trainer is the Cessna, like 172 or 150, one of those.
The Cessna shitbox?
The little shitbox, yeah, which is a high wing plane. So the wings are on top of the plane. The Piper's, the wings are on the bottom of the plane. Other than that, they are extremely similar.
Got it.
So the cowling, these two flaps that cover the engine, one of them just decides to open in the middle of the flight.
Cool.
And it shoots open and it just stays in an open position, and I'm flying this plane. My flight instructor is just, you know, he's on his iPad checking things, making sure we're clear and doing whatever he needs to do.
He's playing Subway Surfers on his iPad.
Yeah, I think so. Well, he holds it up. It helps me keep concentrated when I'm flying.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
So I go, oh God, what is what? I mean, again, I'm pretty low hours, so this is a new thing for me. And God bless my flight instructor. I will not say his name for privacy's sake, but you know him.
I will say your flight instructor has the most flight instructor ass name in the world.
So, and he's like, chill as hell. I think I told you once that if he were to tell me that he spends 6 months out of the year just following the Grateful Dead around, it would not be a surprise to me.
Yeah.
Just a chill as fuck guy. And he looks up, and instead of going, oh, or showing any kind of surprise, he just goes, man, I told them about this. And I was like, you told him about this? He was like, yeah, it did that the other day to some guy. And I was like, okay, well, what do I need to do in this case? He goes, all right, just give the controls back over to me. So he took control of the plane. And if you're familiar with the term yaw, it is a rotation around the Z axis. So yep. Up and down through the plane. Basically what he did is he just kicked the rudder out to where the plane was yawed in a direction that it was, the wind was hit the cowl on the backside,
mm-hmm.
and it just slammed shut again. Now we were close enough to the airport that we had been doing our practice runs at that. He just turned us around and we landed and he, you know, made sure it was bolted shut.
Sure.
And we got home with no other incident. But scared the absolute shit out of me.
No, that would absolutely be a justifiable shit your pants moment, especially yeah. like with the low hours that you have.
Yeah. Good Lord. And he did ask me about 3-4 times on the way home. He was like, you okay, man? You good? Did that shake you up? And I was like, yeah, it shook me up a little bit, man. He's like, do you think it was an emergency? I said, in the moment, yes. He goes, and he turned it into like basically a teaching moment of
sure.
how to deal with stuff in flight and keep your cool, which was, that was really cool of him
yeah.
to be able to do that. So it all turned out very well, but I was like, that scared the shit out of me. So my first in-flight incident happened yesterday.
I'm trying to think of what happened in my world yesterday.
And I sent you the...
I went to the grocery store.
Oh, well, that's... Knowing your history at that grocery store, that could have been an incident.
I did have to deal with that one fucking asshole employee there, so yeah.
What else happened? Oh, yeah, and I sent you the recording that I found online of me making my very first radio call to a towered airport.
Yeah.
And just to draw the comparison, the microphone that I'm using, the headset that I'm using, is real shitty compared to these mics.
We've joked about you doing a episode, just one episode of your fucking airline mic. And oh, I think that would be awful. You would be the so one bad. Editing that episode sure. for sure.
No, I would never do that. That sounds abysmal. And I don't know if you could hear how shaky my voice was.
Oh, yeah. No, you were terrified. Rightly so. It was your first call into the tower and everything.
Yeah.
So I think you told me you and your instructor practiced it for like 10 minutes.
Before it wasn't 10. We practiced for about 3 minutes before I made the 15-second interaction.
I have to do that with every social interaction that I have, so I understand completely.
He did say, though... after I got done, he like hit me on the shoulder and he goes, man, they wouldn't even have thought you're a student. I did good, I guess.
Yeah.
Man.
Could have fooled me.
It was fun. Good day of flying yesterday. So that's my flight story. And I hope I never have another thing like that happen to me again.
You probably will.
I will. Yeah, I'm sure I will.
Yep.
Well,
I don't know how we're going to segue that into Dune.
No, I just say, let's get into it, man. This has been a hell of a preamble.
Actually, you know what? I can segue that into Dune because we are flying into minute 120 through 121.
That is so true.
And we're flying towards this giant volcano that we talked about with Martin last week.
That's right. That's right. We start in media drone shot.
And I'm just going to go right into some Art and Soul notes.
Okay.
Since it's more relevant towards these first 4 or 5 seconds of this minute than later.
Let's do it.
So Art and Soul has a lot of pages dedicated to this 5-minute stretch, really this like 6-minute stretch of movie, but most of the pages are just like full page photos and everything. So obviously can't really talk about those on a podcast, but what I can say is that this section for the southern part of Arrakis, where these mountains are and everything, was a area that was scouted, to quote Art and Soul, equidistant between Aqaba and Amman in Jordan, accessible by either a long car ride or a short helicopter flight. Nice. And this like super rough terrain area was part of what they were looking for, because they wanted to obviously find something that was a very distinct difference between the north and the south in terms of the terrain and how it was structured and everything.
So you tell me that these like crater / volcano things are real? Like that's not CGI?
Art and Soul doesn't explicitly say.
Okay.
However, you know, looking at some of the photos that they have, like this part of the desert is very mountainous.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say that it's not out of the realm of possibility.
That would be really cool if it was real.
Yeah, it would. Which I know is very, very not like us to not have a definitive, you know, answer on some of these things.
I don't know about all that. I think we have plenty of non-definitive answers.
Sure, but
when it comes to matters of landscape and shooting locations, we generally have the right
answers. The information that I have available to me right here at least just says that this area was equidistant between Aqaba and Amman in Jordan, and that's what it was. Speaking of this area, though, it's rough.
Yes.
And it is very hot, because our next cut or our next scene that we have here is a cloaked figure walking through this, you know, heat vapor rising up from the ground,
super shallow depth of field shot.
It is. We'd seen this briefly in one of Paul's prescient visions earlier in the movie as well. But yeah, even through the prescience and everything being cut out, it's that weird, like super shallow shot.
Yeah.
Plus shooting through the, you know, distortions of heat coming off of the ground. Can't really see much other than just a basic, you know, black cloaked figure.
Right.
We all know it's Paul.
Oh, what a spoil the end of the minute. Jeez. No, and we move from this to a slightly wider shot. The blurry figure still walking towards us.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of the depths behind him, we see a sandworm erupting and then breaching and then going back down.
Like a big ass whale.
Yeah. Space whale. Space sand whale.
I don't know if you tried to like clock how high up it goes.
With that, I mean, it looked to be a good ways behind him. So the perspective would not make it possible for me to do that.
If I had to guess, it's probably at least like 10 meters though.
Like up in the air?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Because like, let's assume Paul's 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like several Pauls up.
Yeah.
Plus then the difference in distance between the two of them and everything. So right.
Did not look as big as the worm that he first rode. Was not a grandfather worm.
No, but it was still a big ass fucking worm.
Still a big
worm.
Old boy, for yeah. Sure. Or girl. Who knows? So from here, we see the crowd that's standing in front of the entrance.
Yeah.
So we kind of reverse our perspective. Paul is now walking towards the crowd, and they're all just like standing there watching him walk out of the desert, watching this worm go back into the sand.
Mm-hmm.
One of the coolest shots in the movie, in my opinion, this crowd, this one and one coming up in a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
Some of my favorites.
Yeah. I remember when we were watching this in IMAX, seeing all of this happening in the IMAX aspect ratio and everything was super cool.
Yeah.
But, and also going into Art and Soul here, they call this the Corridor of Anger.
Okay.
Which I think is probably the most apt name for what's going on here. Paul is obviously approaching, and while these are Fremen fundamentalists from the south, they are still skeptical of this outworlder.
Sure.
Not because it's not an issue of whether they believe in the prophecy, because as we know, the Southern Fremen are much more religious in their, you know, fanatics, but whether they believe that this man, this skinny white boy, is actually the Lizan al-Gaib.
Right.
And
they make this known by grabbing knives and getting ready to shank him as soon as he like gets it close to him.
Well, they don't pull their Chris knives, but they definitely put their hands on the hilts, and they're like, they're getting there and they're ready, and they're all just like daggers for eyes staring him down. And we get two people that kind of, you know, step off to the side a little bit, and then there's
they're not doing a lot to make way for him.
They're not, but there's a third person in the background there who's like really giving a Paul like a, you know, kind of looking up, almost like a reverse Kubrick stare, where instead of like turning his head downwards and like looking forward, he's kind of like turning his head back and like looking down on Paul.
Which that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And looking, I'm not
looking down his nose at Paul.
Yeah. And I'm not going to name this specific person, but this one Fremen looks very much like someone that you and I know in our real life. And when I saw this for the first time in the movie, I was very thrown off by it.
So this, we move from the shot of that guy to the shot that I was talking about a little bit ago, which is one of, again, one of my favorites in the movie. It's almost a 90 degree overhead shot of Paul walking through the crowd, and you can see how little room they're making for him.
Yeah. This corridor of anger, as it is called.
And it's massive. There's so many people here, and I don't know if this was done practically or with CGI. It's a lot of people to get together into one spot if it was done practically, but I would not put it past them to be able to, you know, rally up all crew, someone, you know, an entire village around or whatever, just to bring people in to do this, because it looks so good. And if you contrast this crowd shot to the stuff we saw on Gaty Prime,
yeah,
it is a world of difference. It is so much better here.
Yeah. Couple things.
Okay.
One, part of it was done practically, not by a lot. Art and Soul has a picture of the shoulder level shots that we'll see in a couple seconds of Paul walking through the crowd and everything. And, you know, there's maybe he's walking through a crowd of maybe like 50 people or so, but definitely not this many.
Sure.
Right. And your big limitation there is how much are you wanting to spend on costume? Right.
Yeah,
because if you're having to do all of this work for all of these different people, that's a lot of money that scales very quickly. Right.
Yeah, it makes sense.
The second thing, though, with the CG is because this is a much more well lit and more colorful shot. I think that's why it blends a lot better, because we have a lot of earth tones. We have some like kind of bluish tones and everything.
Sure.
It's not a homogeneous blob.
Fair. They're also not doing a choreographed dance, I guess.
Right. It is also that top down looking at everyone's like shawled heads.
Yeah, that's fair.
So there's not as much movement and also more variety in color. So your eyes don't find the inconsistencies as easily, I think.
Yeah. To me, well, okay. First off, to your point about it's a better lit scene. The history of CGI would tell us that better lit scenes typically do not make for good CGI.
Typically.
Especially for desert scenes. Now, clearly they pulled this off. And it's not just like a, you know, take a square of 50 people, cut and paste that square around. Because they're all kind of in like a circular pattern. Like you can tell distinct lines of the people.
Yep.
In there. And that's just really, really good. And that's why it kind of tricked my brain into thinking this looks real, because it's not, I can't pick up on that like cut and paste pattern that I could with the Harkonnen scenes.
Yeah.
So kudos to them. This is really, really cool.
I think it also has to do too with like everything in that shot is all in focus, whereas in the Harkonnen scenes, like, you had varying amounts of depth upward into the stands, which made it weirder.
Sure, sure. Regardless, great shot. I wish we could have stayed here for longer than we did, because we only get it for like 3 or 4 seconds.
I think we were here for the right amount of time, just because... Well,
maybe one more second would have been nice. Sure. Whatever. But we cut to Paul getting to the other side of this crowd. He's made it through the corridor of anger. And we get to see some other, like, some more, like, badass costumes here.
Yeah. I want to, we've talked about her before on the show, but I just want to, you know, remind people that Jacqueline West is the lead costume designer for Dune Part 2 and Part 1. And I think this, what we see here and what we will see in some upcoming minutes are two of her best works from the entire series. We see, by my count, at least in this scene, 12, maybe 13 very ornate, very large hooded dresses.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't just scream Reverend Mothers to you, I don't know what would.
Now, is there only one Reverend Mother, or is there a Reverend Mother for each tribe?
My understanding from what we've been told in the movie, at one point Stilgar says our Reverend Mother is, you know, dying.
Yeah.
But also from what we have in Art and Soul is that different tribes within Arrakis all have their own Reverend Mothers. So these are all of the Reverend Mothers that have congregated to this one space.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the worst convention that you can think of, because we're about to basically be told that, hey, it's holy war time.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's that I find it a little odd that the newest Reverend Mother of them all, Jessica, has such a prominent place amongst them, and stands out as much as she does.
Yes, and no.
If she was on the same level as all these other ones, then she's definitely making herself stand out by her choice of attire. But given everything else, I would have to guess that she holds a little bit higher of a place than the rest.
She would hold a little bit higher of the place because she is the mother part of the mother and the son.
Sure.
From the prophecy.
Right. Okay.
So I think she can, you know, knowing the entire history of the Bene Gesserit's work with Missionary Productiva on Arrakis, hand wave her way as the mother superior of these Reverend Mothers.
Right.
Even though they don't follow the same structure as the Bene Gesserit Reverend Mothers.
Right. Right. Yeah. I believe you there.
Yeah.
And she's the one who is in red. I think if it's not clear, everyone else is in these like earthy blue tones.
Earthy blue tones, but there's also like some
gold,
purples and golds and, you know, olives and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Art and Soul's actually got some really cool photography, or not photography, but collection of images of some of the concept art that they did for all of these. And like, there's so many different variants of the like hoods that they're wearing and everything. It just, it looks really fucking cool.
It's just a
go buy Art and Soul. Like, there's so much stuff in here that I can't really talk about too much just because it's pictures and I don't like, this is an audio podcast.
Yeah. They look great. And we kind of zoom in on Jessica, who is in maroon. Which, again, that's what kind of stands her out. She's in this maroon and gold attire. And we don't get a great shot of her face. She's behind a veil.
Yep.
But we're just meant to infer, hey, this is Jessica.
Well, you can see enough of her features.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And that's where the minute ends, is right after we zoom in on Jessica's face here.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to be back tomorrow to figure out exactly what Paul's going to do when he gets up to her.
I will say, this shot of all the Reverend Mothers is one of the ones that I'm most proud of having from our collection of IMAX cells that we got from our friends over at Shot in the Dark 70mm.
Yeah.
It's very like cool. Seeing that on film, it's so crisp and mm-hmm. so clean. And yep. I love that shot so much.
It's a really good one.
But yeah, those are all of my notes from this minute. Nothing really crazy other than what we've already talked about there.
Okay. I think I'm going to pull that old trick that I usually do of saving my book notes to the end, simply because it would make just a lot more sense to talk about it as a whole. So, sure. I'm gonna save all those.
Cool. Well, I think we'll call today's episode there, and we'll be back tomorrow to, as you said, figure out what Paul's going to do now that he's there with his mom. In the meantime, you can find us online. We are on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com, and you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. We'll see you tomorrow.
See ya.